Ready for our close-up, Mr. DeMille? Ready? Okay. Now, we are at the Lamry Hackett Post 72 of the American Legion here at 30 John Street, Saugerties, New York. It is Sunday, April 24th, 2005. And with us today, we have Bill Allen, who was a tail gunner on a B-29 during World War II. Also, his son Robert Allen is here, and his granddaughter Rebecca Allen, and our crew, Alan Brzezinski, who is our commander. I'm Bill Payne. We also have Matt McElreath and Kate Thornton from the Key Club, who are our technical advisors and assistants. So good morning, Bill. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to be here.
Bill, you served in World War II in the Air Force. Were you drafted or did you enlist?
I volunteered, actually, through the ELS program, the ELS clubs across the country. They were looking for young potential men coming out of high school, maybe going to college. And so two other guys from Rhinebeck went through that program, so I decided to give it a try. So I volunteered, went to New York City down at Grand Palace Theater, and took my exam, passed it, and I went home, and in December they sent me to Albany to be sworn in, a physical up there, and I reported to active duty on February the 2nd, 1944, Camp Dix.
In New Jersey.
From Camp Dix, I went to Greensboro, North Carolina. That's where I took my basic training. Nothing unusual there, you know, except for learning how to march and cadence, you know, and getting a rifle and going out on a range and going out in the field for a few days hiking, you know, big hike, 16 miles, something like that, with packs on and everything like that. And we shipped off to, I took some examinations here, some psychomotive tests and one thing another. And anyway, they shipped me down to Harlingen, Texas. And that was a gunnery school down there. Evidently, I didn't, in the psychomotive test, you know, I didn't have the coordination or whatever they felt I needed for a pilot. But the other side of that was, I think that they needed gunners. They needed, like on a B-29, there was four gunners to a pilot. So, I mean, you can see that they were in demands, all right? So went down to Harlingen, and I had my first flight in an airplane down here, an old Hudson B-2 or whatever it was. And I remember the sergeant there on the first flight, he knew we were nervous one thing or another, you know, and he said, you know, they said they call this the flying coffin. And one guy, like anybody in a gang, one guy says, well, what do you mean by a flying coffin? Well, he said it'll fly if it gets off the runway. So right away, that kind of made us a little nervous. But anyway, we flew up there, and that was pretty good, you know. So we came down, and then went up in an AT-6 two-seater trainer. And they had a 30 caliber machine gun on the back of that. And I remember the pilot telling me, whatever you do, you hang on that machine gun. You don't let that thing get out of your hand. Because he said one guy did, and it whirled, it got in a slipstream, cut around and put a gash right across his forehead. So he says, now, we're going out, and there's some silhouette targets of airplanes down on the Gulf of Mexico. Because we were close to the Gulf of Mexico. And we were told by the sergeant, don't come back with any ammo. If you do, and you tell me you didn't shoot because there was Mexican fishing among them silhouettes, that's the end of you. So, okay. So the pilot said to me, now, when I wiggle my wings, you stand up. Now, he said, it's going to be a little bit difficult, you know. So anyway, he wiggled his wings, and down we went. And, you know, I'm seeing these silhouettes, so I'm up there with that 30 caliber, you know, shooting, strafing them. And he goes on up, you know, and he comes around again. And I didn't know whether I was going to get sick, you know, air sick or what. So when he come down again and strafe again, you know, there was no Mexicans in there then. So then when we get all done shooting, he said to me, he said, would you like to take a ride? And I said, sure. Now he said, remember what I told you. You hang on to that machine gun. And so I said, okay. So now I'm sitting down now. I stood up with a They had a safety belt that latched onto a U-boat down on the floor, right? So he must teamed up with another guy. Another pilot had a rookie gunner in there too. So they get up there, they start doing loops and spins and diving and everything, you know. I'm just hanging on to your life. So anyway, after he gets done, we land, see? And he said to me as I stepped out, he said, "What do you think of the ride?" I said, "That was pretty good." So anyway, we did a lot of, then we go up and I was in a B-24. And they were going to, B-26 was going to tow canvas targets, you know, sleeves out behind. They let them out with a cable, you know. And each gunner on that 24 would have different, he was shooting different colored tip bullets. So when it hit that canvas, that bag made out of canvas, the paint stuck onto that canvas. And they could, when you come down, you could count the number of, like if I was shooting yellow, they'd count the number of yellows, all right? And if somebody was shooting blue, they could count that too. Well, I happened to be assigned to the Sperry ball. That's the underbelly, okay? Well, you hit a crank in a 24, it couldn't land or take off with that ball extended. You had to pump that ball out. And so you pump it out, and you bring the door up until it's inside the ship, and you climb down in it. And then it's like you're in a fetus position in a womb, you know? And it was a computerized Sperry ball, and you use the sight reticles in there was on your foot, like a clutch or a brake in a car, all right? And your machine gun buttons were right up here. You swung around with the, you know, azimuth and elevation and that. And the other gunners, waist gunners or whatever they were, or tail gunners, they'd have different colored bullets too. Well, they let that target out behind that V-26, you know. And but them guys in that V-26 said, "Boy, I said, I bet them guys had a little experience." So anyway, we shot. And we did that for quite a while, you know. And then they had them on a motor car. They had a target behind a motor car, and it was a mounds of dirt that shielded it, you know, the mechanics of the car. But the targets was up above the burns, right? And you stood there in a stationary turret with 50 calibers now. And that thing would go around on a track, about the eighth of a mile. If you notice those midget racetracks, well, they'd go around there and then you'd shoot that target with the 50 calibers. And then we did a lot of skeet shooting and in the back of pickup trucks too, moving. And they'd have these high and low houses on the curves and on the straightaways, and you went around there and you were locked in on the back of the pickup there with belts, you know, to hold you in there. And we did a lot of that shooting, and some of it was, you know, shooting out of a stationary right on the ground.
You were using shotguns for that kind of practice.
12-gauge pumps.
Yeah.
And I saw some city kids, when they come in at night, they never got the gun up to the shoulder, they got it here, and them poor kids, they had to go to the infirmary, you know, and they were right back out there the next day, and their arms were so black and blue, some of them were bleeding, and right back out there the next day doing the same thing. And then finally I went to, from there they sent me to Lincoln, Nebraska. My class was 44-2, I believe it was, so they sent us to Lincoln, and I had a walk, they said you're going to get a furlough. So I wired home to my mother and said, "Send me money." So she sent me money. So they got out. They called us out one day, lined us up on the street, and they said, "The names we call out, you go on this side of the street, and if your name isn't called out, you stay right there where you are." So these called names, they went over the side of the street, and they had about an equal number on both sides now. They said, "All right. The guys on this side that we called out is going to go to home on furlough. The rest of you guys are going for reassignment." They're going to the 8th Air Force in England. So they put us on a train. Where do we wind up? Clovis, New Mexico. And now we're in there with a central fire control system. We're going to learn that on a B-29. Never heard of the airplane. So there we shot more skeet. Did we ever shoot skeet? And so then they sent us from there to Harvard, Nebraska, and that's where we formed into the 505th. And a lot of the officers, bombardiers and navigators and pilots are already there, but now the radio operators started to come in, the central fire control and the other gunners, plus the radar operator started to focus in. So we formed into crews. And I happened to be lucky and got on to Major Dendy's crew. He became a flight leader in the 42nd Squadron. So we flew some old rackety B-29s there, were beat up, well. So we flew there, and then we got our orders to move to, I got a furlough, I think it was 10 days back in Rhinecliff. And then we went to Kearney, Nebraska, and that's where we picked up our new airplane from Wichita. We built in Wichita, Kansas, brand spanking new. So he said, our Major Denny said, come on boys, let's hurry it up, because he said there's a front moving in and we don't want to be hung up here. So we had all our B-4 bags and everything, duffel bag, and threw them in up into the plane, climbed up in, and off we went. Well, we're headed for Mather Field, California, but Mather Field was just outside of San Francisco. Mather Field was socked in. So we had to go to Fairfield, and they never had a B-29 land on that field. And I can remember everybody lining up alongside that barbed wire fence from the runway, looking to see if this giant that they never saw before could make it into that air, you know, into that airstrip. And down we came in there, just over the mountain and down in. And right away, the colonel of the base, he comes out in a Jeep, you know, and he had the MPs out there, and he put security around that plane. If we left that airplane and we left something in it, we couldn't get back to that airplane to get anything. So we stayed overnight there, and I remember going out that morning, and you could see everybody over by that fence there seeing this thing take off. Well, then he got it off of there. And then we went into Mather Field, and we got our orders to go overseas. And we left there, I think, around late afternoon. And I remember when Denny got to the Golden Gate Bridge, he took her down and went under the Golden Gate Bridge. And we were headed for John Rogers Field in Hawaii. And we stayed overnight.
Could you show us a picture of what the B-29 looked like? You brought it, and I think this would be a good time just to show people what it looked like.
This is a schematic of it.
You can hold it up the camera. I'll pull it out.
That's the interior of the plane. It's got 141 foot wingspan, and my position in the tail was 99 feet from the nose. It had 22 gas tanks, individual gas tanks in the wing with a big center wing tank.
Bill, you could point to the position you were in way in the back there.
Right here.
Tail gun.
There was 12 machine guns on the ship into 1, 4, 5 turrets, each one holding 1,000 rounds per gun, so that'd be 12,000 rounds of ammo.
Thanks, Bill. So you got orders to go overseas.
Yeah, so we're over there, and we stayed overnight, I think, in John Rogers Field. We took off for Kwajalein. And Kwajalein Island, and I remember Kwajalein Island. The only thing I remember about that all the palm trees were cut right off. There was no leaves or branches on them, just stumps from the Navy bombardment, see? So we landed there, we didn't have any ammo on board yet. So we got
to... was one of the islands that the Marines and the Navy had to take from the Japanese to establish an air base, correct?
Exactly. And most B-29s that were going into Tinian and Saipan and Guam landed in Kwajalein, you know? Wasn't a very big island, as I remember, and I remember they fueled us up and they loaded ammo in our cans, all right? And I remember them telling us, you now are in combat zone. So Denby said, now be on the lookout. Everybody at battle stations, and you be on the lookout. So we did, and we flew into Saipan. Tinian wasn't ready yet. They were still, the Seabees were still building them runways. So we stayed there about a week on Saipan. Maybe not quite a week, maybe 3 days, because then we made a hop down to Guam, stayed overnight, I think it was, and came right back to Saipan. Now they told us that the runway number one was ready on Tinian. So we went in, and Denny teamed up with two others from the 42nd Squadron, Smokey Aylesworth, was on our right wing, and Bob Finch was on our left wing. We formed a three-flight plane. And we come in, we buzzed the field. And I remember that they pulled the graders and their road rollers over to the side and let us come in on that coral, the three of us. Aylesworth cut off, he peeled off on the right side, and he landed first, Dendy landed second, and Finch landed third. Those were the three 29s that was on that field at that time. So we had to pull guard duty on our own planes. The Elvises knew to do it, you know, and so we...
There were still, my understanding is, and you can correct me, there were still Japanese on different parts of the island who were still fighting, correct?
When we were on guard duty there, I was operator of a portable generator, and we kept that generator. We had our machine gun, Thompson submachine guns, and we always carried our sidearm with a 45 Colt. And there was a couple of carbines there we had, but we also was ready to get that generator going and operate the turrets. The turrets were loaded with machine guns. And the hard stands were just cut out from sugar canes. I mean, maybe 10 feet and you'd be in the sugar cane. And they had wild pigs around there, I guess, but wild boar they call it. And you'd hear this trashing through the weeds, and you'd hear shooting all that night, you know. And they'd go over there in the morning, they'd see a pig or something like that, you know. And sometimes they were goots. They were the natives, you know, who'd come along looking for food. And some Japanese got it too, you know. But we didn't have any incidents like that. And then the 67 Seabees, this is how we got tied up with them. Their commander got with Major Denny and said, look, what we'd like to do is adopt your airplane. And for that, he said, if you let us put our logo on your ship, and we'll have the artist do it, and he'll also put your logo on too. And he said, if you let us do that, you can have the run of our mess hall. We'll do your laundry for you. All right? You come to our theater anytime you want to. Come to our PX, any of that. We had to run the mill of their campsite, you know. So Christmas Day, they invited us up for Christmas dinner. I was eating K-Ration beside, you know, when we first got in a pup tent. And so anyway, we got there and went there for the dinner, and we had turkey, dressing, mashed potatoes, and the whole work, you know. So I remember guys were coming out and said, what are you having for dessert? He said, ice cream. I said, oh, ice cream. I thought I had died and gone to heaven. So anyway, so they said after we had dinner, they said, come on up to our area up there. We got a tent. And he said, we'll go to the movies that night. Okay, sounded good. So they showed us the tent, and it was nice, and all the canvas, but it was built over 2x4s or 2x2s, and it had a platform. You had to take a couple of steps to get it in. And each one had a foxhole, and it had clotheslines between the tents. So it's getting dark, so we're down there, and we throw the blankets out on the grass, you know, and the theater was slanted this morning. The movie just came on, and all of a sudden the air raid sirens blow. Christmas night, everything blacked out. The Marines, they had security. They were responsible for the security of the island. They had 90mm any aircraft guns. And they hit the searchlights. And they were scanning the sky, and the guys said to me that I was with two guys. He said, come on with me, we're going for a foxhole. So these guys, they knew where they were going, all right? So we're running between the tents, and I'm getting hung up on sheets to guys, pairs of pants and one thing or another, you know, they get in your face and you're fighting them. I thought I was going to lose those guys. But finally, I did get there, and we fell into the foxhole, right? And we were looking up and watching the searchlights, you know, and we could hear, we could see searchlights in Saipan. Now, those Japs came from Iwo, all right, and they were Betty bombers. Now, in the Army gave them code names. All male names were fighter planes, like Zero, Zinc, Oscar, Val, Tony. Bombers were after females, Betty, and that was their mainstay, a twin-engine Betty. And finally the Marines on Tinian got that baby up there in the lights, and they opened up with them 90 millimeters. Well, at that time, they had 7th Fighter Command had Black Widow P-61s, and they were up there. And over Saipan, we could see huge explosions. And I would imagine either they were ammo dumps or they were oil drums or whatever, or B-29s. That's what they were really after, you know. And so anyway, we saw that one Betty get shot down. I don't know if it was from a fire or whether it was from an anti-aircraft flak. I don't know. But that's their welcoming to us on Tinian Island.
You have a picture here of your ship and your crew. We could maybe show that to the camera.
Yeah, sure. This here was taken immediately coming back from Nagoya, Japan. General Davies is there shaking hands with Major Dendy. This is our crew. And there's one gentleman in here, right up, let's see, right here. Joe Epton, he was a flight surgeon, and they occasionally went up with crews to, you know, to measure and to analyze the stress that was created, you know, by the length of the missions. The average length of a mission was about 14 hours. The longest one that we made was to Koriyama, which is 150 miles northwest of Tokyo, 17 hours it was. So they're pretty long.
You've got your picture in here too, right, Bill?
My picture is right here. Dog tags. Mm-hmm. The dog tags are hanging out on me.
And that's the name of your ship, the Indian Maid.
The Indian Maid.
And over here is the CB insignia was on the side there.
Yeah,
right?
It's an Earth with, I think, a pick or a carbine
CBs? The CB.
Machine gun.
We got a lot of CBs in our post.
Yeah.
Okay, we got it. Sorry to interrupt you, but I want to make
that's all right. That's all right.
So after that air raid, then you started making missions?
Well, we did some training missions, and so we went to islands that were still inhabited with the Japs, but they were abandoned, and I won't say totally abandoned, but like for Pagan. Pagan was just north of Saipan, about 100, maybe 25 miles. And we go up there, and there was an airfield there at one time, but it was loaded with pockmarks. It looked like Swiss cheese from the constant bombing and everything. And I think the Japs didn't want anybody to know that they were there, because if they did, then we would really go in. So we pounded that one. And then the first mission was against Iwo Jima. And we got credited for that mission. And we went up there to soften it up for what we didn't know at the time was the invasion and we pounded up pretty good. And I distinctly remember that. We led the formation, one of the formations over there. And as we were coming off the target, we were supposed to have P-38 escorts. But they didn't show. So anyway, we come off the target, and I remember the bombardiers up in the Pollock up in the front said that he called out a fighter or a plane about 12 o'clock level. And that's all he said. So, you know, we're sitting there, and the flak is up there. There's flak, and there's phosphorus bombs. The Japs go up above the formations, and then he dropped these phosphorus bombs, and they explode above the formation. I don't know, maybe a couple of hundred feet or so. And they look like a skyrocket, 4th of July, where the balls come down, you know, where the stars come down. And they throw out this white phosphorus, and it all comes down. And if any of that landed on your wings, or your fuselage would burn right through. But they weren't too successful with it. So anyway, he kept saying, it's coming in closer, it's coming in closer. And finally, I'm turning around trying to get, we have a man on our right wing and a man on our left wing. So I'm turning around, you know, waiting to see what I can pick up this object that he's talking about. He didn't say what kind of a plane it was, or whether it was a fighter or bomber or what it was, and he didn't know whether it was an American or what it was. So it kept coming in, and finally, I turn around, and here comes this K-9 camouflage olive drab paint with a big red ball right behind his cockpit. And I hollered out, "Jack!" I remember, "Jack!" So by the time I got my guns on him, there I had a B-29 in my sight. So he goes down and he makes a, goes right vertically up, makes a loop and comes down, and Chael N. Charlie, he's the guy filling in the diamond in the last flight. And I could see spent cases coming out of his guns because they come out into the airstream. That was one of the few target turrets where they come out. And I said to Tony Ugolia, our right gunner, "Didn't you see him?" He said, "No, I didn't see him." And the only guy I see shooting that whole formation was that guy at Tail and Charlie on the end. And finally, the other gunners on our ship, we believe he was asleep. He could sleep standing up. He's one of those guys. And so I remember at one reunion, we were talking about that, and we asked him flat out, "Were you asleep?" And he said, "Yes." I mean, here a guy could be jeopardizing 10 other guys plus the airplane, right? That's the last thing you want a guy to do is sleep when he's in combat. So anyway, we got through that one. Then our first mission was ODA, high altitude job. And that's the one we dropped the bowling ball. Debbie threw the bowling ball out.
Tell us about that, will you?
Well, there was a chief petty officer in the 67 CBs that brought a bowling ball, regulation bowling ball from the States. I don't know what he thought he was going to do with a bowling ball on Tinian, but he probably didn't want to give it away. He figured, well, I'll tell you when I go somewhere. Anyway, he bought this ball. So he brought the ball to Dendy, and he asked Dendy, he said, "Look, I want to paint this ball up like a billiard number 8 ball, the 8 ball in a billiard pack. And, you know, they're black, they got a big white spot on it, a big 8 right in that white background." He said, "Will you deposit it over Japan?" He said, "Sure." He said, "Oh, you give me the ball, I'll drop it." ODA, high altitude. Of course, we're depressurized at high altitude. And everybody's on oxygen, right? So when they get ready to release them bombs, Dendy gets up out of his seat, goes back to the navigator's compartment and the radio operator. They sit back to back, and right there is the bulkhead that opens up into the bomb bays. So when them doors came open and those Pollock, the bombardier, triggered those shackles, them bombs went down and he threw the bowling ball out with it. So I can imagine what that must have hit. So they got quite an article in the Exchange on that. They said that was a secret weapon, and the Japs are startled and confused because they're looking for the other 7.
Well, just hold it up for you, Bill. That was your squadron newspaper?
Yeah, this was the Island Exchange.
Yeah, so just so people can see what it looks like.
Yeah, it's the Island Exchange that they put out, I don't know, weekly, I think it is. Mm-hmm. They have actual guys, reporters, that go seek out information for this, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's on the back page. Anybody would like to read it. It's got a column on the back there that talks about it.
About the bowling ball.
Yeah, about the bowling ball, yeah.
Made other missions besides that, of course. How many missions did you make altogether, Bill?
33.
33 over Japan?
Yep. Now, that included the Iwo. Now, let me say why we got 33. The rest of the crew, except the gunners, had 35. That was the tour, 35. But see, when we went to low level with the incendiaries, they dropped off 2 gunners because they had no LeMay come out and said there's not going to be any guns on board. That's his first order, no gun, period. The next mission, though, he said, "We'll put the tail guns in, but we're only going to get 100 rounds per gun."
This is General Curtis LeMay, who commanded the Air Force.
Major General, stationed in headquarters on Guam, in command of the 21st and 20th Air Force. 21st Bomber Command, 20th Air Force. Those pilots were really up in arms, and his staff told him, "You're going to lose 75% of your force on that first strike." Well, what he did before. Well, let me go down to the high altitude first, and you'll finish, then we'll get into that.
Yeah.
But anyway, we flew high altitude, but the problem was we never had too much success. They called it precision, but it was far from precision. We'd go up there anywhere from 25 to 30,000 feet, and the winds, we found that the cloud coverage was thick, heavy, and the winds up there were anywhere from 150 to 160 miles an hour. And what they found out was that that later became known to us now as the jet stream. They thought that that was just a coincidence, that in a couple of days it would get back to normal, but it never did. Never did. So the results were lousy. There'd be a lot of smoke and debris and dust down there, and we thought we did a great job. When the photo shots went up, the planes the next day take photos, they found the roofs on the factories and everything else, cars in the parking lots. So after a while, it got very frustrating, and Arnold, he was getting disgusted. And so, because that 29...
That would be Hap Arnold?
Pardon?
Or Hap Arnold?
Hap Arnold.
Yeah.
That was a unique Air Force, the 20th. The 20th got their orders from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. No theater commander had authority over that Air Force. None. Normally, the theater commanders take charge of the Air Forces as assigned to the theater, like MacArthur, Stilwell, Eisenhower. Arnold was smart. He figured that they all put the bid in to get those 29s, the Navy, MacArthur, Stilwell. The Navy wanted them for long-range reconnaissance, and Arnold said to the Navy, look, they're misusing the bomber. This thing was supposed to go 4,000 miles carry 10 tons, and go 35,000 miles high, or 35,000 feet high, and here we are going to use it, some of them want to use it for reconnaissance. No way. So he talked to Marshall into getting this, say, this B-29 force, the 20th Air Force, assigned to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff put Hap Arnold as a CEO, just like a corporation. He would do the day-to-day operations. But the Joint Chiefs, when it came to them atomic bombs, they made the choices. So anyway, LeMay figured if he didn't do something drastic pretty soon, he was going to lose his job. So he got in touch with Akers over in the 8th Air Force, and he wanted to know information on how the British was doing with their incendiaries. Now the British did their attacks at night with incendiary bombs, and the Americans did theirs in daylight, high precision. Okay, but they took a beating. And some of those, they took a beating early on. So anyway, they decided he was going to take a shot at it, come in low level, and anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 feet, where the winds was anywhere from 10 to 30 miles an hour. And he was going to use incendiary bombs. And they were going to use the M69, which was Well, it was meant just for Japan, the type of buildings, you know. They had this architect from New York City who lived in Japan for 18 years, and he was familiar with this, with the type of construction. So what the Americans did, they went and they imported from the Far East these materials, and they built out there in Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah. They built a village to test this M69 bomb, and it proved to be highly successful. So they put that into the arsenal, those M69s and the M47s, which is a napalm, weighed about a little less than 100 pounds. And the M69 was just a little bit over 6 pounds. But what they did, they put that in what they call a 500-pound cluster. And they put them, the bomb actually had a tail, like on a kite, just a 3-foot streamer rag. And the casing was three inches in diameter and 20 inches long. And they packed those into this cluster bomb. And it was sealed by a wire bands, all right? And when it got at a certain altitude, the explosives would break the bands and they would scatter. Maybe 2,500 feet, something like that, above the ground, you know. And then the M-47s, though, what they did was band them in three wide and three deep. That's nine in a cluster. And one of those would go up on a shackle, that cluster of nine. And that band would break. But they were a little bit heavier, and so therefore they could penetrate better. So they use those, too. And they use those, the Pathfinders use those to light up the target area. All right, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. But anyway, that was our bomb load. That's what he was going to use. So on March 9th, that's when it all began. He put up over 300 B-29s, and they're going on Tokyo. And General Powers went up there to observe. He was commanding general of the 314th Wing on Guam. And he went up there and he was going to observe the results of this thing. So they went in, anywhere from 5,000, and the pilots and crews were really... One guy even wrote his obituary out, and he asked one of the... He took it over to the chaplain. And his pilot said, "Why are you doing this?" He saw him writing. He said, what are you writing? He said, "I'm writing my obituary, and I want the chaplain to see if he gets delivered." He said, "Why that?" Because he said, "I think I'm going to survive this thing." And they thought he was crazy, this LeMay. But they all went. They all went. And I tell you, before this low-level stuff, the morale of the force was getting pretty low. But the results were bad. I mean, they were going up there, risking their lives, and no results. So anyway, they go up. And it was successful. That night, there was high winds down on the ground. And they unloaded them bombs and them fires. And 15, very near 16 square miles of Tokyo burned that night. And so then it continued from there on. And they burned these cities one by one. And we went in one night there on May 25th. Over Tokyo, and we got in there, dropped our bombs, and somebody yelled, I think it was the center fire control gun, he said, "There's a 29 right above us." And I looked around, and there he was, the fire and the glow of the fire was shining off his aluminum skin. And there he was. I don't think that guy was 100 feet above us. And he had his bomb bay doors open. The question was, did he release his bombs, or were they still in the racks? Now, I know this, that the first thing you do when that last bomb clears that bomb bay, you close them doors. That's just like putting full flaps on an airplane. You can't maneuver. So anyway, we yelled, and Woods, he was in our pilot, Captain Woods. He made a sharp bank to the right and got out of there. But the question is, that's the risk that he was in smoke and debris, and it was risky. One thing that was very strictly adhered to, they were told this over and over again, you had to maintain your assigned altitude and timing. If you were assigned, because each squadron was stacked 200 feet up, there would be 200 feet between, like, for instance, if we went in at 5,000, 482nd, 483rd then would be at 5,200 feet, and the 484th would be at 5,400 feet, and that's what they did. And the groups were about 3,000 differential, in at least in one article that I saw. So you had to maintain your altitude and your timing, because there's going to be other planes that's going to be coming in and occupy that same space later on, right? So the thing of it was, though, if you got those hot spots down there, those were explosions, and there were some areas where it was just like a forge. I mean, it was just white hot, like down there, you know? And you get into that smoke and that debris that was coming up at your altitude, it was a rough ride. And it wasn't unusual for those updrafts to send you up maybe 400, 500, 600,000 feet, just like that. Now you're in somebody else's airspace, right? And you can't see them. And that's the risk that was involved.
So you made 33 of these missions, including Iwo Jima.
Well, I did about 13 on the the firebombing raids, okay? Mm-hmm. Then there was the mining missions.
That was to drop mines in enemy waters?
Yeah, what they did, Admiral Nimitz wanted to get the Air Force involved, the 20th Air Force, to mine the Inland Sea. And it was called Operation Starvation. And so LeMay, he resisted it at once for a time there, and so did Arnold. But the thing is that LeMay was running out of incendiary bombs. He put an order in for 36,000 more tons. And the Navy told him that they were on the docks, but it would take them 2 weeks to deliver. So he said, well, okay, I might just as well go and mine. So they went to mining, and they used two types of mines, 1,000 and 2,000. We running out?
We're good. Keep going.
We went 1,000 and 2,000 mine, pound mines, okay? We're going to mine the Inland Sea, and vital part of that Inland Sea was the Shimonoski Straits. That was a small, narrow body of water that separated Kyushu from Honshu. And that was the outlet out of the Inland Sea where the Navy base, Kauri Navy base, was the Japanese Navy base. And also their transport ships to supply their forces on China, Korea, and also to bring back the exports, you know? To import material and whatever foodstuff, because Japan would be impounded, and the Third Fleet was operating up there, so they were practically sealed off. So they were using that Shimonoski Strait, and it was another strait that opened up into the Pacific Ocean, was the Bungo Strait, and that separated Kyushu from Shikoku Island, which is just north of Kyushu, and we mine that one. And there were two types that we mostly used, magnetic and acoustic. They had sensors on it. They call them the magnetic sensor and the other one. Now, any waters that were up to 15 fathoms deep, they used a 1,000-pound line. But the one that was over up to 25 fathoms, they used the 2,000 pounds. And the magnetic nines was the sensors would pick up the steel hull. The acoustic ones were the ones where the propellers and the turbulence created by the propellers would trigger that one, okay? There was a couple other bombs, that types of bombs, they called it the ship count. And what that would do, they would set that like maybe every fifth ship that went over, it would go off. What they were trying to do is confuse the Japs so the Japs wouldn't be able to go in there and detect where they are. So they were dormant down there on the bottom, but when that fifth ship went over, or it could have been the third ship, then that would go off, see? They thought they had the area cleared, and they didn't. And then there was one with the delay on it, which would maybe go a week before it would go activate, you know, something like that. And then later on in the war, when we were up there and our ships were, they knew that our ships would kind of have to go in there to supply the prisoners of war and also to bring in the occupation forces. They had mines that they put there that would inactivate after a certain period of time, like shelf life on a piece of grocery, you know.
How long did it take you to fly from Tinian to your target and back?
The average mission is about 14 hours.
14 hours.
Yeah, it was about 7 hours up, 7 hours back.
And you ride over the Pacific. I know you have a map that was issued to you. Could you show that to the camera, please?
This was for air, you know, if we had a ditch or parachute out and landed into the sea. This was given to us. Okay. It has the water of Japan, had the islands of Japan on it.
You take a shot at it?
That's China there. Yeah.
I understand these were printed on fabric, so if they got wet, they were still usable?
Yep, that's right. Yeah. That's right. And this
You also have a mirror there. Let's fold this up for you, Bill.
Yeah, this mirror here, this was given to us for if we were in a life raft and you've seen aircraft go above. What you do, you hold it up to the sun, and then you sight right through that little cross in there, and that's supposed to reflect, you know, and the airplane hopefully would see that glare, and they would suspect something down there, and they may go down and investigate.
You did have ships in your force that didn't make it.
Oh, yeah.
How many casualties would you say you had in your unit?
I think it's on that plaque there. I think...
I should hold that up now that we're there.
Yeah, this is the plaque now of the 505th that's on the Tinian. It's a much larger plaque that's over there. It's bronze, mm-hmm. but this is a miniature one. Okay.
You got that, Nick?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Let's see. Here it says here... talks in here. Let's see now. No, I thought that did give the casualties here, but the number 187 sounds familiar to me. I wouldn't put my hand on the Bible with that all. But this talks about in the mining operation. LeMay assigned that entire mining operation. It was called Operation Starvation, and that was it. LeMay assigned that to the 313th Wing. Said, Jim Davies, that's your baby. You plan it. You execute it. The 313th, they had four groups. He assigned each group 1 month. The month of June, our group, the 505th, took over the entire mining. We put 6,200 combat hours in that operation. And so then we went from there. Airborne Nimitz wanted us to do something to help them, try to knock out some of these kamikaze bases on Kyushu, mm-hmm. along with the fighter bases. Because if you remember, when the fleet was down there supporting the landings on Okinawa, they were getting creamed by these kamikazes. In fact, the kamikaze hit the Indianapolis, right, while she was down there supporting. And also the carrier Franklin. In fact, we went over the Franklin when she was being towed over to Hawaii and back to the States. She was smoking burning then.
You also mentioned to me when we talked before that at one point you had to land at Iwo Jima. You had to make a landing. Could you just tell us a little about that?
Well, that was the last mission that we uh-huh. and then we very near collided too. And we very had a mid-air collision like that. We were trying to get into that formation. It was a high altitude, and there was a lot of groups involved, and there was all about three wings, I guess, the 313th, the 73rd from Saipan, and the 314th from Guam, and that puts hundreds of them up there. And what you do, you get into a big circle. Mm-hmm. And they go in there and they get your position. Well, we're trying to get into our position, and Cahill, he was trying to get into his, and he was coming right in like that. And all of a sudden, Cahill saw us, and Iliff, he saw it, and they separated like that. I was scared to death. Last mission. That's when we ran out of fuel and we landed on Iwo. They filled us up, and then we got our bent prop. Then we had to turn around and go back and get that.
You mentioned to me that you had seen the Enola Gay, the B-29 that dropped the atom bomb.
Yep.
Tell us a little about that, and then explain to us, because we'll get to the end here, about how it was for you at the end of the war, how you felt about that.
Well, let's see. They came over there. We didn't know anything about what they were doing, but we saw these pits being dug. Right across from the tower, the control tower, and I saw this big. Well, us gunners went down to the flight line about every day, so we saw this thing on a skid, a pallet like, and it was huge. It was all yellow, and I never saw a bomb like it before in my life. And it was fat. Well, it would come out to be Fat Man. Okay, I didn't see Little Boy. So anyway, what they would do. Day of the mission, they'd take these atomic bombs, and they are, they got them ready in a temperature-controlled building. They came down and they moved them down to where this loading pit was, and they put the bomb down in the pit. Down in the bottom of the pit, there was a hoist there, a jack light. I don't know if it was electric, run by electric, or if it was air or what it was. They put the bomb there, and then they bring the ship over top of the pit, and they raise it up into the ship, okay? And when I went up there, they called us the day it was dropped in Hiroshima. They called us into the briefing rooms and told us that the NOAA Gay from the 509th had just dropped a new bomb that was supposed to be the most powerful bomb that the world has ever known, and that would destroy a complete city. And so that's all was said. And then what? That was on the 6th of August. The 9th, Sweeney went up and took Fat Boy up, Fat Man, and they did the same thing. They loaded that down into the pit. Of course, his pit had to be a little bit bigger. And they raised it up into the ship, and he took off on that. Well, his first primary target was Kyoto. But that was socked in. And he was given orders not to drop by radar. It had to be a visual drop. So he hung around. And beside that, one of the planes was not there to be with him. They usually went up there with two or three other planes, weather instruments, and that kind of thing, to measure the vibrations and the concussions and heat and all this. Finally, he had to go. Fuel now became a critical point. So he went on and went down to a secondary, which is Nagasaki. And that was sucked in too. But just as about ready that he was going to drop by radar. He was going to disobey orders and drop. He didn't come all the way to just take that bomb back. So what he did, just as he was getting ready to do the radar drop, the bombardier said, "We got it, we can see it, we can see it." And so there was a break in the clouds, and he dropped. But he was off target about a couple of miles. But it still did an awful job, you know.
So after the second bomb dropped, it became pretty clear the war was going to come to an end. Do you remember how that announcement was made, or how you felt?
No, LeMay still kept sending them up there.
Missions were flown even after the two bombs were dropped.
Especially the 315th wing. They had airplanes similar to the 506 with the 509th, rather, the composite group. They had no turrets on their ship at all. The skin was clean except the tails. But one thing they did have, they had the most latest technology radar that was made, and that was called the Eagle. And their primary job was to take out the oil industry up there, the refineries, the storage tanks, the distribution centers, and all that. And they would go at night.
You remember when the war actually came to an end, how you felt?
Well, I was in San Francisco. I left the island of Tinian on August 12th and went back to, that was funny. I went back on C-54. And that was a 509th plane too. That's why they call it the composite. And it was a C-54, and the name of it was Green Hornet. And we flew there, and we got into Johnson Island, fueled up, and went into Hawaii. And we had an officer on board, and he said, "You guys want to go right on through to the States?" We said, "Sure." So he said, "Give me your papers." He said, "I'll take care of the papers. You go up to the mess hall, you get your meals, and meet me down here on a flight line, and we're going for the States." We get up there, and bingo. There's the guys. There's the guys that's been there a couple of weeks. And they were mad. Oh, we're in there. So anyway, get back to the States. We're in San Francisco. I was in a movie theater when they announced that the Japanese had surrendered. The lights came on in the theater, and they announced that the Japanese had surrendered. And everybody is exit the theater. All the emergency exits would be open and leave the theater. So I go out, and there was just one wall of humanity from one sidewalk right over to the other sidewalk. And I remember there was a circle there, and there was a statue, and I see Navy personnel, because that San Francisco was Navy. And up there, they were up there, you know. And I actually saw those streetcars. I saw all kinds of services, take that, and got onto that streetcar, and they lifted it right up off the track. There was Navy, there was Army, there was Marines, and I couldn't believe it. They took that trolley car right off of the track and set it off to the side. And that there was where I spent my day of surrender is in San Francisco.
So you got out of the service. What did you do for a career after that?
I went and worked for, did some odd jobs right after I got out. I got out in 1945, on November 14th. And I eventually wound up with IBM, worked for over 35 years.
You mentioned that you do go back to reunions from time to time.
About every year. Last year I was out in Missoula, Montana. Yeah, and then I went over to the Air Force Academy, the 67th Air. I usually go to theirs. And and I'll tell you now, you people here in Kingston is going to see a reunion this September, from the 7th to the 11th. Now, I met out there in Missoula the survivors of Bataan Death March and Corregidor. You have a guy here from Kingston, and he's hosting that group here in Kingston this fall. They're staying at the Ramada Inn, and he's putting the programs together. I think he told me they were going to have West Point. One marina in Kingston's going to give him a barbecue. He was trying to work out some sort of arrangement with Steinbrenner, but that hadn't been, there was no deal really closed on that one yet. But that's pretty much it.
Can you tell us your feelings about how your experience in the military affected your life and how you feel about it today?
Well, I've been a military man. What I mean is I've always been an ally of the military. I'll tell you that right now. But I remember when I was still working for IBM, I got a call one Friday. I believe it was Friday. I got a call from a student from Lehigh University in, I think it's Pennsylvania, right? And he said that his class was taking a survey and trying to find out people who participated in those firebombing raids where a lot of millions and millions of civilians were killed, and that's true. Right? Want to know if I had any regrets, okay? So I thought about it, and I said, well, how'd you get my name? Well, he said we were searching through and got with the government and found out, what groups participated, and we come up with your name. And I'm sure many, many others too. So he asked me if I had any regrets. I said, no. He said, why? You killed a lot of women and children. But I said, when I think about it, I think about what they did over there in Pearl Harbor. I think about the rape of Nanking, right? I think about the way they treated our prisoners of war. And I said, they started that thing, and I have no regrets.
What's your first name, Mrs. Ballou?
Stephen.
No, Mrs. Oh, Mrs. Bernice. You got it?
Okay.
All right, we are here at the Veterans History Project at the American Legion, Post 72 in Sorbonne, New York. And it's Sunday, June 5th, 2005. And today we have Mr. Stephen Ballou. Also present is his wife, Mrs. Bernice Ballou. We have Alan Brzezinski, our commander, Matt McElreath, who's the Ballou's grandson, on our technical team, and Nikia Brzezinski, and also Kate Thorne. So good morning, Mr. Ballou. How are you? Good to see you. Can you tell us, in your military service, were you drafted or did you enlist?
I was drafted.
And when was that? Remember the date?
December the 5th, 45.
December the 5th, 1945. So at the very end of World War II.
In Albany, New York.
In Albany, New York.
In the Army building.
In the Army building. Where were you living at that time?
Flatbush.
In Flatbush? No, not in Brooklyn.
Just outside of Kingston.
Just outside of Kingston. You didn't get a chance to pick the branch of service you went to? Just in the Army, yeah? And do you recall what your first day of service was like? Did you leave Albany on a bus or
Yeah, most of them in New York City. Been on a subway out to a ferry, and a ferry over to Jersey, to Fort Hancock, New Jersey.
Fort Hancock, New Jersey.
That's where I got all my needles and uniforms and all that stuff.
Did you have your boot camp there?
Nope.
Where was that?
Then we shipped to Alabama. Fort McFarland, Alabama.
Fort McFarland, Alabama. Mm-hmm. And what was boot camp like?
To me, it was just like being camping.
Yeah.
I was raised on a farm.
Uh-huh. Okay. So if you've been raised on a farm, this was not hard work, right? Mm-hmm. Do you remember what the drill instructors were like, or how they treated you?
No, they weren't bad. They weren't hard. Mm-hmm. As long as you did what you was told. Yeah.
But you had no trouble with boot camp or getting
down and all that.
So where did you go after boot camp? What was the next stop?
I got a 10-day delay and route home. Then I went to Topeka, Kansas. From Topeka to Kearns, Utah. Kearns, Utah to Oakland, California. On the ship and over to Manila.
So you went to the Millard in the Philippines, huh?
No, no.
And
we stayed at Clark Field for about 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Then we shipped to Clovin Leyte. In the Philippines, to become a truck driver.
You became a truck driver? Mm-hmm. Were you in the Air Force end of the Army at that
yeah.
time?
Oh, they yeah. put us in the Air Force before we left Alabama.
Before we left Alabama.
Yeah.
And the Air Force was still part of the Army, right?
Yeah, right. Army,
yeah. So you became a truck driver in the Philippines,
right?
What kind of trucks were you driving?
Six bikes.
Okay. Yeah,
just six bikes.
Yeah. And you had told me that you had Japanese prisoners of war helping you out?
I had three prisoners. No. Yeah, three prisoners on my truck, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They loaded it and unloaded it. I just drove it.
Where were they kept when they weren't working with you? Were they locked up?
Oh, yeah. They had a prison camp.
Prison camp. Yeah. How'd you get along with them?
All right, good.
Yeah.
I couldn't understand them, but I got it.
Yeah.
In the morning, they go out with a trailer truck to the camp. They brought all the prisoners in that work
mm-hmm.
with us. And, you know, I pick up my tree, take them down to the... The Clovin Leyte was an Army supply depot.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all mountains of supplies. And the job there was to take those supplies into a warehouse like, and they opened the boxes, sorted out all the stuff, and they recreated it and shipped it out. And my job was to take all the trash and junk from the warehouse to the dump to get done destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
That's what my prisoners did. They loaded the truck.
And they were,
no
problem behavior-wise? They didn't want to escape or anything like that?
No. But they knew better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really. There were still some Japanese up in the hills at that time, weren't they? They haven't given up yet.
Right.
Now, you mentioned to me one time that our military was getting rid of its excess airplanes. You want to tell us about
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
238.
Out on the airstrip, they stripped the planes and took all the instruments, tires, wheels, and engines out. Then they loaded the fanning gears and run them to the push them all up in the pod.
Brand new 338s, right?
I don't know if they were brand new, but they fought in the war.
They didn't need them anymore, right?
No.
What was it like in the Philippines at that time? Did you get any leave or any chance to get off the base?
Weekends we used to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I went to the beach where MacArthur landed to come back.
Yeah?
And they got a monument there. Went swimming.
Went swimming, huh? Did people get hurt during this time? Did some injuries?
No. Just regular accidents, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Minor.
How'd you keep in touch with your family?
No letters.
Mm-hmm. Did you get packages from home?
Yeah, I got a few. Got a camera.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Not much.
Was there any entertainment at all?
Hmm?
Was there any entertainment?
When we were in Manila before we shipped to Leyte, they had a, in a big hotel there, they had a show put on. And we put women actors and that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. That was it for the time you were there. How long were you there in the Philippines?
4 weeks. 1 year.
1 year?
Oh, no. My whole service was 1 year.
Uh-huh. So the Philippines was part of that year. Right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Did you get to get any place else in the Philippines? Or just
yeah, Okinawa.
Oh, you went to Okinawa?
Yeah. Open Bay today, we went to Okinawa.
Mm-hmm. And you were stationed in Okinawa for a while?
Mm-hmm. Three months.
3 months? Where were you in Okinawa?
Naha Harbor.
Naha Harbor.
It was the airstrip there.
Mm-hmm. What was it like? I guess it was pretty well blown up still, right?
Well, you could see where the tanks, you know, you say that we were restricted. We couldn't travel around because you say there were all kind of tunnels and might be mined and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So we had to stay right on the base and down to the where we worked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was there Japanese prisoners there too, or?
No.
How did Okinawan people get along with you, okay?
All right.
Yeah.
We had, they used to call them fooks.
Yes.
The women used to come in and take our laundry and do our laundry first. Yeah. Then I had to pay them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did we just in Naha all the time you were in Okinawa?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Did you get to Japan at all itself?
Oh, yeah. I was from, I became an aircraft mechanic.
Oh,
okay. In Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And I was assistant crew chief. Mm-hmm. So whenever you worked on a plane, you had to go up with it, you know, because they figured if you figured it was safe enough to go with it, you know, it was okay.
Yeah.
So I got to fly to Japan.
What kind of airplane was it?
C-46.
C-46. Well, that was the
old cargo plane.
True carrier. Was it 4 inches or 2 inches?
No, two.
Two. So you flew that up to Japan?
Well, it flew on, yeah.
Yeah, flew on. And where'd you go in Japan?
Where did you drop the bomb?
Hiroshima. Nagasaki?
I wonder if it, which one it was.
Uh-huh.
Of course, a lot of the buildings were, all you seen was the framework.
Uh-huh.
The metal framework?
Yeah.
So
it was really devastating, huh?
Yeah.
Did you get around Japan much?
No. Just overnight.
Just overnight,
yeah. We flew our cargo in.
Mm-hmm.
They unloaded it. He stayed overnight. You know, paid.
Mm-hmm.
The guy stayed in the barracks. Back to the plane, to the hotel, back to the plane.
So that kept you busy, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
There goes Chris. Did you get any medals or citations? Did you get the occupation medal, maybe? Yeah, nothing else?
I'm not seeing my papers on the
paper.
Yeah, not much.
Yeah. Then you, when your service came to an end, you were just 1 year, where were you located when your service came to an end? You're okay now?
Yeah. Come back to San Francisco, to Oakland,
mm-hmm.
and we went to Dix.
In New Jersey?
Dix.
Mm-hmm.
Got discharged.
They decided they only needed you for 1 year, huh?
Yeah.
They were starting to cut back on the size of the military? Yeah. So you stayed healthy the whole time you were out there, didn't get sick?
Tell them about the spare plane you worked on, that buddy.
What?
The spare plane you worked on. Remember the one that was junked? You put it back together with your buddy?
Oh.
Yeah, tell me about that.
My crew chief and I went, we had an extra mission to do this.
Uh-huh.
We went out to the boneyard, they call it boneyard, where you put all the old wings.
Yeah.
We got a C-46, tore it back to the airstrip.
Uh-huh.
Him and I worked on it for 2-3 weeks. Had it for inspection, had to inspect everything.
Uh-huh.
And then when you get it finished, then you had to take it up for a test hop.
Yeah.
And we flew that, that's the one that we flew to Japan.
Uh-huh.
Then we flew back to Okinawa, and from Okinawa to another little island, you know, we got stuff there.
Uh-huh.
And then we bought the ice cream.
What?
And we took bread and other supplies to the island, and back, coming back, we bought a couple of dead or soldiers.
Mm-hmm. They had been killed on the island?
No, no. They died. Mm-hmm. They said that's part of the joyous.
Oh.
Down on the earth.
Mm-hmm. So you had to return these dead soldiers to Okinawa?
Yeah, we went to Okinawa to the airline.
Yeah. That's, that must have been quite a sad trip.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell them about the guys trying to ship booze around, too.
Yeah.
The alcohol they're shipping around.
Oh, we don't want to hear that.
Yeah, we don't hear that. So far in history.
We flew to Dark Field.
Uh-huh.
And the pilot gave me a 45. I almost, he said, you stay on this plane, you know that nobody here or in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there. And in the middle of the night, this Jeep pulls up. Tony, who, Father Rudy was in that. Mm-hmm. They had a cheap load of whiskey. They loaded the whiskey into the train, and they took back off, and I had to stay there and guard that whiskey. The next morning, flew back to Okinawa.
The pilot was in on this, I think.
Oh, yeah, the pilot, co-pilot, navigator. So right. Yeah. And then after a while, I heard that our outfit was known as
transporting whiskey around, huh?
Yeah.
Tell me about the monkey the one guy had, too.
Oh, the monkey.
Well, tell me about the monkey.
This one guy had a monkey who was one of these cold weather monkeys, like,
mm-hmm.
His tail was frozen up. He only had a stump about that big.
Uh-huh.
He had him on a chain, and he had a post out in the yard with a house on top.
Yeah.
The monkey used to keep the monkey up there.
Mm-hmm.
You could go out there and sit, and the monkey would get on your shoulder, and he'd go up through your ear and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If he come along, the guy at home, yeah, he come along and say, get him, Jarbo. And he'd fly right into your
chair. Wow. So he was like an attack monkey, huh?
And one day they got him drunk. And he stayed in this house for about 4 days. Never come out.
So you have some photographs here, right?
Yeah,
here.
Yeah,
okay.
Oh.
How old were you then?
There?
18.
Yeah.
You show it to the camera? You get that, Matt?
Yep. All right. Got it.
So you got your papers there? Here you go.
Did my discharge.
Yeah.
Honorable discharge.
Mm-hmm.
To my service record.
You were discharged at Fort Dix?
Yeah. When I got discharged in December,
mm-hmm.
And I had a whole month, January was a furlough.
Mm-hmm.
You said you're supposed to get a month at least you were there.
Yep. So you got the World War II Victory Medal, huh?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Yeah. So you got your honorable discharge at Fort Dix, and where did you go then? What happened after you got out?
Come home.
To where you were living?
Flatbush? Flatbush, yeah. Back on the farm.
Back on the farm. You went back to farm work again?
Yeah. Here until I had a job on the Local 17 Union, Laborers Union.
Laborers? Local 17 laborers?
Yeah. Been a laborer ever since.
Uh-huh. So you worked as a laborer the whole time? Did you get any benefit from the GI Bill or anything like that at all?
Oh, I got a muster now pay.
Okay.
That's about it.
Uh-huh. And then where did you, was that Union down in Poughkeepsie or was that local work?
Newburgh.
Mm-hmm. And you worked on construction for all that time?
All that time.
Yeah.
Until I retired.
I take it you're retired now, right?
Yes.
Okay. And, how do you feel like your military experience affected your life the rest of your life? Not much. Working hard before you got in and working hard all the time?
It was an experience.
Mm-hmm.
Today it's like a dream. Yeah. Having so long ago, it is.
Did you join a veterans organization?
Yeah, belong to the American Legion Chief.
And are you active in the organization?
Not really.
Did you ever go to any reunions or keep in touch with any of the people you were in the service with?
Well, I did work there with one fellow for a while, and then all of a sudden just petered out.
Where did he live?
South Carolina.
South Carolina?
Yeah, tell him about the two buddies you had. Like, you were pretty close to them. The two guys you had.
Three guys?
Yeah, the three of them.
That was Richard Barnett from Kentucky, and fellow from South Carolina, one from Texas, I forget his name, and so on. We used to pal around together, so.
Then he, which one was with the one Filipino girl?
That's Richard Barnett. He had a Filipino girl from Leyte.
So you've gone on, you got married, you had children yourself, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. How many children did you have?
Three. Two girls and a boy.
Mm-hmm. And Matt, your grandson here, right?
Yep. And three grandsons.
Three grandsons. Okay. Okay. Well, thank you a lot for sharing your experience with us. We appreciate it. Thank you for your service.
Thanks a lot.